accession number 20940, reel 6.
Got you, Scott, reel 6.
Okay. Right, he'd walk out across the cornfield down to the German positions and talk to them and get them to come back with him. You know, he'd tell them things like, the war's finished, like, you might as well give in now, why not, you know, come up and get some decent food and all that lot. And he'd bring in the prisoners, just by talking to them. But the thing is this, he went out once too often and jumped in the wrong bloody hole one night, and we don't know what happened to him. Just don't know what happened to him. On the other hand, talking about prisoners, we did a patrol out towards the ruddy farm? It was a Grand Film de Buisson and another one. We went out there and we got caught out in the open. And Jimmy Sinnott was leading the patrol. We got off out the road towards Breville, where this farm was, and we got caught in the open. Whether it was by luck or whether it was by whatever for Germans, right? But whether they had put down a stonk in that area, and we walked into it. But anyway, when you're in the open and you're caught by a mortar stonk, you don't stay there, get out of it, you know. And I come back down, we just gone past a house, and I come back down the road, saw the front door of this house opened, and jumped in. There's about 3 little steps inside, down. I jumped in there, I come face to face with 2 Germans. One's standing there with a rifle, one's got a Schmeisser, that's a P-40 submachine gun. And I don't know who was, surprise, surprise, like, you know. Well, but before I knew what happened, they slung their bleeding weapons down and put their hands up. That was it. And I walked out of the house with 2 prisoners. And I said to Jimmy, I said, look, it's not worth going any further. I've got 2 of them here. So we said, oh, well, I'm back again. That's all we're going out for, to get a couple of prisoners. We're just very, very lucky, you know, because we didn't get caught in the stonk. And I found them 2 geezers like that. It was very willing to walk out, you know. Over, we come back with 2 prisoners. I've still got the names of them. I found out the names in that them 2 blokes. I'd like to find them now, but you don't find them, do you? Anyway, but that's what we done every night, every ruddy night, until the best night was the 26th of June. And I've got letters from Peter Young about this. We went out to do the positions on the Gunnival Road. 2 assault sections and a support section. And I was in the support section in one of the bleeding bomb craters just off the road. And Portsford went in with a section left. Eddie Edwards went in with a section right. And our job, the support section, was counterfire. Any German MGs opened up, we fired at the German MGs. The flashy, you see the flashy, fire in that locality, keep them down. Anyway, Ponsford's gone left onto the road. Eddie's gone right. And the first thing we heard was Eddie's section. Now, there was a little of a shindig for about a minute, 2 minutes. Then it was quiet. Then it started on the left, Ponsford area. And there's an MG started up. So I'm on the left-hand side of the section, the support section. So this MG started up. So I'll give it a burst. And like I said, I don't play about 5 round bursts. You have to bloody make. We're going to, you know, all right, some people, you're wasting ammunition. No, I want to win, I want to get him down, you know. So I just give him a mag, you know. But I was hardly finished. It don't take long to fire a magazine, you know. And I'd hardly finish, the ground in front of me bloody muzzle erupts. It was either a mortar bomb, a grenade or something like that, but it was pin on, you know what I mean? It was absolutely shit on. So I thought, sod this, and I moved to the other side of the bomb crater, which I found later was a better position anyway. And then the next thing happened, Ponsford. He's pounding back across the field. He jumps into the shell hole in this bomb crater, and he hits the bottom, doesn't he? And he says, look, I've got Ronnie Bridges with me from the Dorset Regiment, he's my number 2, and I think there's the other gunners there, you know, with the brain guns. And other people, the bodies are coming back, straight in a bloody bomb crater. And Ponsford said, right, all up, you know, quick check, out. He said, get out. So, move out. It'd gone pear-shaped, It was wrong. The only one thing to do was get out. Because by this time, the German defensive fire was coming down, mate. When he let go, he let go, you know. And the old bloody Gunnival Road was coming alive. So Ponsford said, get out, get out. So I said to Bridges, give us your mags. You've got the spare magazines for the gun. You put the magazines down there, wasn't it? And I said, get out of it, you know. And I started blapping off. I was just going from one side to the other, then going back again, like, you know, anywhere. And the others went for it. I kept going. I think I'd gone. I lost me north a little bit, I think. Anyway, I kept going until they were all clear, all gone. Then I fired up the rest of my ammo. Then I found out I'm there with a gun, pile of empty magazines, no ammo. All I got then was a Colt and a knife. And I was on my own. Oh, well, blimey. You know, come back to earth, like, what do I do now? Anyway, I thought, I'm going. That's the way. That's the general direction, sort of thing. So, out of the hole, there's a big cornfield at the back of it, into the cornfield. Now, it's something funny or silly about this. I'd gone out on that job, and I don't like army overcoats. But that night, and it was raining, I went out wearing an army overcoat. I thought I had some sort of protection. I slung this overcoat over me. It was the first thing I ditched. And then I'm crawling with a ray of corn, which is standing high that time of the year, with his Bren gun, no ammo. I had to leave some of the mags behind because I couldn't put them anywhere. And anyway, there I was. Then I decided, which one am I going? I don't know which one I'm going. There's no sense of direction. So I thought, well, that's it. I'll just lay here. And I just lay there the rest of the night. Just getting in the rain, getting pouring wet and all that, you know, soaking wet. And then I just lay there. So then the light, first light comes up. I thought, oh yeah, hang on. The beachhead. They'll be putting the barrage balloons up soon. Daylight. Up goes the barrage balloons, like from the ships. That will give me an idea of direction. So I wait there. And what I thought would happen did happen. Like I said, these barrage balloons going up on the beachhead. So I thought, there they are. I've got to go there. All right, they came in. So I start crawling with in a cornfield light. I don't want to stand up. Not in daylight. Not there. And then I start crawling through the cornfield. Wrong. I'll come out of the cornfield. But I'll come out the wrong side. All right? I'll come out. But there must have been someone very alert there. Because I come out the bloody cornfield. And I thought, oh, shit. Get back. I just thought that, like, crack, it's around over me head, woof, someone spotted me, and let go, you know. So I'll get back in a bloody cornfield. I thought that was silly, wasn't it? Because now they know there's someone in here still. Anyway, I've gone crawling again. What I thought again was the right direction. I've come out the other side. I've got a burst. Burst of MG fire. I thought, oh, this is, you know, this is ridiculous. And I lay there a bit, I had a good check up, and I thought, let's get me position, my goal take. Anyway, next time I come out into a sweet pea field, and I knew I was on my way then. I went through the sweet pea field, and eventually I could see this farm buildings, the Grand Film de Buisson. So I thought, that's it, go to the farm. Then I thought, this blatant gun, it's useless. So I took it to pieces, stripped it down. I put the gas regulator, the firing pin and spring, and the extractor stand spring in my pocket. Then I thought, I'll make sure, and I took the trigger group out and put them in my bleeding pocket. I put the barrel over that way, the body group over that way, the bipod down there, and all that, you know, just distribute it to the winds. Make myself lighter and easier to cross. You're crawling with a 23-pound lump of iron, you know. And anyway, away I went. Got through the sweet peas, and it was just flat, plain grass. No cover, nothing. And then, how far away, I don't know, it was a hedge, and over the hedge was a bleeding orchard that goes into the back and the side of the farm. And it finished down in what we call dead man wood. Anyway, so I thought, what am I going to do? If I crawl across this slowly, he'll see me. And what sort of a target am I going to make? Right? Or it's going to be there, or up and run and dive over the edge, you know. So I thought, well, I don't know. And I've always been a bit of an impulsive person, so up I've got and I ran for it. Dived over the edge, into the orchard. Nothing happened. Nothing happened, see? Anyway, I've gone from one tree to the other, using them as cover, into the back of the farm. And I've always got to the back of the farm, and a ruddy tangerine comes out of the farm. Tangerine, raw marine. Right? He's been watching me. As I got near, like, well, he's right, well, I just put my hand up. He gave me the signal coming. And I walked towards him, like, and as I got to him, I started talking to him. I said, I'm three commando, got stuck on a bleeding job last night. He said, we've heard about you. Anybody else out there? I said, how do I know? I said, as far as I know, I'm the last one in. So he took me in a farmhouse, and they was a standing patrol. You know, standing there, sit there for a couple of hours, and like, and there was an officer in there, and he said, you're all right, they give me a fag, half a cup of tea, a lump of chocolate, you know, and I sat there having a nap, and smoked a fag, had a cup of tea and a bit of chocolate, and that's all they could give me, nothing else. But I spoke to this officer, told him what happened. Yeah, it's okay. Then I had to walk back to the base, which is another couple of k's, another couple of kilometres. Walked back, walked into three troops position behind the Chateau d'Amperville, and he went, oh, well, look what's turned up, you know. And all my spare kit had gone. They'd all distributed it. I'd have this and they have that and all that. You know. I got it all back. It's normal procedure. If you're gone, you don't need it anymore. So, you know. And I got it all back. But then the postman said, you better go and see Bungie, because he'll want to know all about it. So I went and see Bungie, give him a complete report of what happened, you know, from the minute, because I didn't know what Pornsford had said. And anyway, told Bungie what had happened, what I did, and all that lot. Right, he says, and the gun? I said, well, you know, stripped it down, threw it away. He said, a very careless soldier, very careless soldier. He said, go back and find it. Peter Young, I said, go back and find it. I said, right, and he said to me, he said, take Corporal Grant with you. Corporal Grant was one of our sniping corporals. So I did. I had to go out and get Grant and tell him what Bungie had said, and we went out looking for that bleeding gun. But we went back, not the same way, we, you know, we went out to the left of the farm, then over towards the bleeding cornfield like that. And old Grant is saying to me, he's saying, you got any idea? I said, I think I can go where I was laying down when I threw the pieces left, right and centre. He said, we'll go back there and circle out like that. He said, we've got to find the pieces. But I told Peter Young, I said, I've got the spare parts. They can't use it if they find it, you know. So, anyway, we went out. We didn't find it because Jerry started amusing himself. You know how? Chucking mortar bombs at us. The Corporal gone in the end, he turned around and said, it ain't worth the bleeding trouble, Scotty, and we went back. Yeah. And that was that incident finished. But as I found out at one of our reunions after the war, I told this incident to Peter Young, reminded him of it, and I said, you told me to go back and find me gun. He said, did you go? I said, yes, I did. You told me to go, I went. He said, I was only joking, you bloody fool. Huh. Anyway. We got moved from there to the Bois de Bavant, the Bavant Woods. We took over, we relieved 12 para, and it was in a situation such that you could only move two blokes out and two blokes move in, right? And the thing was, it was situated right near a T-junction, again, a famous T-junction, right? And when we got there, our troop had to line the hedges, sort of thing, whilst two out, two in. It takes a bit of time. But the Germans must have twigged there was something going on, because all of a sudden they put down a mortar stonk, on the T-junction again. One of the first casualties was Johnny Barnes, my oppo. And he had a German 81mm mortar bomb laying right in front of him. And it was peppered, head to toe, and they got him on a stretcher eventually and took him away. He was like a pound of mincemeat, But the thing is this, he survived. He's still alive today. And I think I can say without contradiction that every year he goes back into hospital and they're taking lumps of iron out of him. He's living up in Preston. I send him a Christmas card every year and he writes me letters like, you know, but I've been up to visit him in it. But every year they're taking lumps of old iron out of him. And the point was this, Ted Pritchard, Norris and myself, we got away with it because when we got to the T junction, we realised we was going to be one of the last sections to move in. It's going to be a bit of time, right? So we went off the T junction into a little wood at the side and we started to have a brew up. We got a little fire going, we got a cup of tea, make a cup of tea while waiting. And so we wasn't on the junction like when the stonk started. Of course, we had to give an helping hand afterwards to get rid of the casualties and things like that, you know. Everybody mucks in. And then we moved into that position. And it was, you moved in down the edge of the forest. The field at the back was a minefield, was a German minefield. In that corner of the field was a German unexploded bomb that had been dropped down. The marine engineers were trying to dig it out. And this field was supposed to be a minefield. Anyway, we was along the edge. The first ones along the edge were the medium machine gun section, the Vickers. And we was just between them and the next edge row. And my dugout was the nearest one to the cookhouse. What was our cookhouse? Well, we called it a cookhouse. It was a ditch where they was cooking the grub for the bloke. And if it was a regular thing, it was just mortar us any time of day or night, you know. And most times, there'd be someone up there getting a bit of grub, and they start mortaring. So where they go? First place, straight in my ruddy hole. I was always shoveling somebody's dinner out, you know, with a spill here and diving in. And it was a funny place to buy the bag on, because you could walk or go down the rides. You could go there and walk about all the morning and not see a body. You knew they were there. You wouldn't see a body. Looked like a ghost. And then you say, all right, there's nobody there. And some people go back in the afternoon, they'd be about 2 yards inside the wood and bump into a patrol of Germans, you know. It was a crude place. And also we had a listening post. And it was 40 yards from what you call Iron's Farm. And you had a telephone underneath a blanket, a field telephone. You didn't use it, you just used the bell on it. You see any apparatus of it? And they used to have a periscope there as well. And you used to listen and look through the periscope and you could see 40 yards in front of you, the buildings. If you heard a noise, we used to look, search, and make sure somebody was in there. If there was somebody in there, we used to go under the blanket, go 1, 2, 3, and if it wasn't our own mortars, it'd be the artillery, blast it. And the Germans would be in there, they get blasted, mate, and maybe they went. But I'll tell you what, 10 minutes, 15 minutes later, they was back in. How did we give up? Anyway, what we did there, we had a .50 Browning fired electrically, and a loudspeaker beside it. And up in the trees down the edge row, we had a ghoul's mask, like a pumpkin for, what do you call it, Halloween night? And at night, it was lit up. But in it, or in the branches of the tree beside it fixed up, we had a Mark V airborne Sten with a magazine on it, and it was cocked. And there was a sort of Heath Robinson device on it to fire it. So what had happened is this. Sometimes there'd be a bloke come up, he'd get down the dugout, he'd pick up a microphone, and he'd give him a talk in German on a loudspeaker. You know, usual crap, right? Give up, come over to us, you'll be well fed and all that. Anyway, and then if he didn't get no answer, he'd give him a couple of bursts on the ruddy .50 Browning. And at night, they used to light up the thing up in the tree, right? And give Germans enough time to look at it. And then someone would go and pull the string and fire a couple of bursts out of it. But the only thing with that is someone had to get up there and change the magazine every so often. You know, all these little irritations, like, you know, that's all it was. Because he used to do the same sort of thing, you know, just to make life a little bit uneasy. But then one day we was told, stand to, get dressed, pack everything. When you get the signal, we're moving forward. And it was the break out from the beachhead. And from there we went forward, went down into Bavant, through Bavant to Pityville, through there to Valleville, got to Valleville, and we found a para hanging in the trees there, been there since D-Day. still hanging in the bloody trees. What was it, a German air acquisition? You know, and some of the airborne aids that come up after us, they cut him down. Anyway, we got to Vallerville, and that night, Paunceford, because up the straight up the Vallerville Road, a straight road, a dead die, was the Vallerville Bridge. Now, the Vallerville was supposed to have been destroyed by nine independent para RE. It was reported as destroyed. Bullshit. They found out since that the bridge they destroyed wasn't the bridge they should have destroyed. It was another bridge. Right? At Vallerville-le-Petit. Anyway, Paunceford gets briefed. They want a recce patrol up to find out about that bridge. So Paunceford goes with a sergeant whose name I don't know. They get a good way up the road. And the last thing before the bridge on the right is on a big house. He gets past his big house. There's a couple of houses on the left, big house on the right. He gets past that. There's a tree felled across the road. So Paunceford says to his sergeant, right, it's not worth both of us going any further. So Paunceford stripped off. And the whole lot there was flooded, which you can understand. But right by the road was a big anti-tank ditch, flooded. It gave us good cover, matter of fact. But Paunceford stripped off, left his clothes there with his sergeant, and he swung forward, right up, because he got right up to the bank of the bridge. When you were there, the bridge was just there. Right? We had to get to the bridge, the good bridge. He got right up there, and it was ogling the bridge. He could see the German sentry, and he knew the bridge was intact. So after a while, he's come back. He got to where he left his clothes and his sergeant, and the sergeant are pissed off. Taking his clothes with him, thought, well, he's been a long time, he ain't come, you know. He went. So Paunceford got out of the water, like, he started taking leeches off himself, and he's walked back down the road, starkers. Got back into this German ACAC position where we were, where we stopped for the night, and reported in, to all that. Got his gear back, gone to bed. In the morning, free troop, we all briefed, to go and get that bridge. Right? And we're going to do it on our flat feet, in daylight. And you've got about, how many kilometre straight road to go down? Now, there's something I've got to say here before going any further. When we first got in that German ACAC position, the dugouts were beautiful. They were really well made. What they'd done, all the doors that they found in the area surrounding, they dug the pits, the floorboards were doors, the walls were lined with doors out of houses, right? Mattresses were on the floor, sheets and blankets for sleeping, all that, well organised. The only thing was, when we first got there, they says, A section, B section, that take which whole lot. And who was it? It was either Ted Pritchard or someone said to me, Scotty, there's something funny in here. He says, I don't like it. So, that was my job, so he minds the demolitions of the booby traps. So I said, what is it? I said, look. I went in, I found one of the floorboards, the door was up like that, slightly rested on the other one. The bed was neatly made, and it was turned back, very inviting. Turned back, as if someone's going to get a bed. The door's in the back wall, but there was a little gap like that. And all I could see was something like a cotton going between two doors. And I went, yeah, I said, out you go, I'll have a look, you know. And I come to the two doors on the floor, and I thought, well, that, if someone steps in, it's going to go, so it's a pressure switch. So I did, and I had a look, yeah. Then I looked at the blankets and where the bedding was laid back, and I thought, if someone dives into that and pulls a, that's, again, there's a pull switch there, you know. And I thought, yeah, and that's the charge in the wall there. So I went up the wall, and I pulled this door slightly forward and over a bit, and there was a litre, a bottle, I think it must have been a litre bottle, in the wall, with a detonator in the bloody top where the cork should be. So I left the door alone, and I walked out, and I said, iffy. And I said to the blokes, give us your toggle ropes. So I got as many toggle ropes as I could, joined them all together, went back in. I found this ruddy lead, put one of the toggle ropes around the lead. I didn't touch it. Just put the toggle back in round the eye, you know, and then put the other one on, and I come outside. And I said, everybody get back, get down. And I started pulling it in. Then I got a resistor, and it started going woof, like that, you know. And it went poof, the bleeding lock went up in the air, you know. If they'd have walked in there and done what the Germans thought they'd do, that bottle of blood exploded, you know, and it went up, boom, they'd have been buried alive or buried dead, you know. But that was the only booby trap I ever had to deal with, that one. Anyway, the morning after Ponce with Ricky, we went up there, strength, one troop, number three troop went up for the bridge. Well, we got as far as the house on the right, and we Badger Anson, as a bombardier out of the artillery, Badger Anson, and Ronnie Bridges. There was Ronnie Bridges with his rifle, Badger Anson with his Thompson, and me with a Bren. We found a position in there what the Paras had used on the night of D-Day. Eight Paras come through there, and they'd used this garage at the side of the big house for, I don't know, but they'd made a hole in the wall, so that was all nice for us. And from that hole in the wall, she straight down the edge row and that, where the bridge was. Anyway, the other section came on the left-hand side, right, they got the houses, done a quick search in the houses, make sure nobody was there, and they started going forward. And that. And what I forgot to tell you, the night before on his recce, Ponce would have found these bloody crocodile tanks. You know, these little mini crocodile tanks, all in their hides beside the road. Well, he'd done what he could to disable them. Well, as many as he could. But we get down there, search the houses on the left, get in the position of the house on the right. The next section started working its way down. And one of these bloody things come down the road. Clatter, clatter, clatter. Everybody went armour. Disappear. And one of our blokes, Johnny Hawksworth, he's a guardsman as well, he walks out in the middle of the road, he picks up a block of wood, he walks out in the middle of the road, put it in the middle of the light, he's rested on it, and he's gone bang, and he's firing at this bloody thing coming down the road. He's got £1,000 of explosive on it, and he's trying to knock it off with a rifle. And it didn't. It did bouncing off, you know. But anyway, something happened, and it spun round on its own cable. Something happened to it, and it spun round on its own cable, and that's where it stopped. So the lads looked at it for a bit, and then we had a bloke called Neil Thompson, a new officer. He decided, well, it's run up its own cable, it's out of control, and they can't detonate it, you know. So we took them up, and they got up past it, and as you got towards where this tree was across the road, Germans opened up. And you could see the bark and the wood coming out the bleeding tree trunk, you know, front there. And I was going up that side of the road, across the road behind the tree trunk, into the water log ditch the other side and up the ditch. Then it come our turn. We went up there as well, run past the bloody derelict tank light, the thing that didn't blow up, up to the tree trunk, across the road, down into the ditch the other side. Now, I found out recently that the radio bloke's name was Cossie. C-O-S-S-E-Y, Cossie. And I've never forgotten him for this, because he was in that waterlogged anti-tank ditch. And every time the Germans opened up with us with a tank. They had a tank up there. We didn't know that, but they had a tank the other side of the river. And they opened up at us. And we'd come forward, and Badger Anson and myself was in the fields over to the right. And that bloody thing opened up. But the thing was, it was whistling over our heads and exploding behind it. They couldn't depress their gun enough, therefore they just fired two bloody eye. So Badger Anson said, get forward. The closer you got to the tank, the safer you were, like. Good logic. But I'm afraid, son, I was bleeding paralysed. I was paralysed. I thought, you know, this is it. We're out in the open, we've got no cover, that ruddy thing, you know. Bang, great, big clods of earth flying all over the shop. I lost me north. Sorry. But Badger got up, didn't he? He kicked me up the arse. He gave me a bleeding good boot, wallop, move. I did. That's what it needed. Shook me out, like, you know. And either that was all right. We got over, got in a ditch with the others. And if you can imagine, this ditch was overhanging with all weeds and that. And we'd all working our way along the beach, along this bloody dyke, flooded dyke in the water. But the thing that amused me, you could hear, and every time I come over from the tank, this bloody radio bloke, he's got the 18 set on his back, and he's going down. You can see the aerial. It looked like a periscope or a submarine, like. Anyway, we got right up to the bridge, to the River Deves, and there was a German slit trench there, L-shaped slit trench. In. Now,